At Vampire Insider, we try to be mindful of the lived experiences of our listeners and feel it is important to note that this episode of the podcast contains potentially triggering discussions regarding race, domestic violence, suicide ideation, and sexual assault. While we appreciate every listen we receive, it is more important to us that our listeners feel safe. If this subject matter is too much for you personally, we understand that you may need to take a week off, and we hope that you'll come back to listen to us again next week. If you or a loved one is dealing with domestic violence or its aftermath, please call the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or visit their website at 222thehotline.org.
Greetings, loyal listeners and savory inferiors. Welcome to Vampire Insider, the super unofficial podcast dedicated to recapping and reacting to AMC's new television series that reimagines Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire and is also part of AMC's Immortal Universe. In each episode, hosts Joanne Palumbo, Christina LaRusso, and myself summarize the episode, talk about Easter eggs, discuss standout characters, interrogate inconsistencies between the book and the series, dissect our favorite characters and their arcs, and provide a body count. Please join us now as we dive into episode 5, A Vile Hunger for Your Hammering Heart. Hello, Christina LaRusso.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, Joanne Palumbo.
But I thought I was being left out there for a second.
Yeah, you definitely.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Super great. We had some good technical difficulties to start with. You know, that always puts me in a sweet mood.
Tense up in this bitch. And I mean, why not? Because this was a crazy episode.
Let's move right into our hot trash hot takes.
This was a big wow episode for many reasons. It was a great episode. I loved the episode. There are problems, big problems. And the AMC is going to, I am afraid, have to answer. Well, I'm not afraid. They are going to have to answer for some of the stuff. There's domestic violence. There's suicide ideation. There's sexual assault. There's racial issues that really need to be addressed. We have been talking about how race is front and center in this series, and there must be an ongoing conversation. And I believe AMC and the showrunners really have to show some sensitivity to that in an ongoing way. It has to be recognized. In this episode, I feel like they miss the mark on that a little bit. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in episode 6, but this episode has caused a lot of turmoil online and with the fandom. It has caused us to have many conversations after watching the episode and digesting it. And so there's a lot to get to in this episode.
There was also a lot that happened in this episode aside from those two things. We had an extremely intense moment between Daniel and Louis in Modern Day Interview. We learned that Claudia is collecting trophies. She has a titty in her drawer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who among us doesn't? I mean, it's like a sachet.
We see, you know, Claudia take off. We learn where she has been, what she's been up to. It all does lead up to that moment of domestic violence scene. So there was a lot to this episode, and there is a lot to unpack. I think we're going to really do our best to fit all of that in for everybody.
Just in general, it was a very good episode. It moved the story forward. It confirmed Claudia's role as the catalyst and the source of contention between Louis and Lestat. Her presence widens those fissures that were already there and now is just added an extra layer of stress and drama, which makes them even more apparent. They're in a toxic three-way relationship. They're not kind a lot of times to each other. They're scheming. They're resentful. So all those things are very real. And for someone who has, especially for someone who has gone through something like that, it's definitely going, but it could very well be triggering for those people. To that end, I think they should have had a trigger warning. You know, I don't have any problem with them portraying these characters as bad people, because guess what? There are bad people in the book, too. The book purists can't really say, well, Louis and Lestat would have never fought like that. They actually did.
They did fight.
In the book.
Yep. And we're going to get to that. talk about the differences between book versus show a little bit.
Okay, so after the cops leave, after they did the whole raid on the townhouse, Lestat turns to Louis and says, you know, we were happy before her. And Louis said, basically, the fuck we were. And Claudia looks at them and says, who am I supposed to love? Who's my Louis? Who's my Lestat? No human would want me. Perverts, little boys, you know, goes on about that. How are you guys going to fix this? Which one of you is going to fuck me? Mm-hmm. And Lestat says, well, you're not my type. I like a fuller figure. It reminded me of the scene right before Claudia feeds Lestat the little boys. And he's playing the piano and she says, oh, I have a gift for you. And he says, I hope it's a beautiful woman with endowments you'll never possess. It's different in the way he chastised her about her body and the fact that she's never going to grow up. But it's similar in the fact that he chastises her about her body and that she's never going to grow up. And I love that scene from the movie. So,
wow, you're a sociopath.
I am.
I like when he mocked her for never being able to grow up.
That is the tension in the book. She is resentful that her body will never grow. In the show, it is very much more about sex than it is in the book. In the book, it's just this longing to this feeling of this frustration. Because of course, in the book, she's much littler. She's five. So she's thinking about it in, you know, how is she, what kind of a companion will she have? She's always going to have a parental companion. She can't ever have just a, you know, like a companion.
She can't even get into the movies.
Right. And in the TV series, she's a little bit older. Well, quite a bit older. And she's, as a matter of fact, able to head off and take off on her own, which is what she does. Now, that never happens in the book, except for like she'll go out from time to time at night and then people will bring her back home. And
right.
And then so oftentimes that's how she attracts her victims. And she does do that, but she doesn't ever leave for extended periods because she's a child body.
And she can't really, in the books at least, she couldn't really move the bodies around and hide them efficiently.
And in this, she's able to. And so we get this whole new history for Claudia that's invented. I don't think it's as much of a departure from the book as I thought it was, which is expose her to be this very diabolical character. And you all were talking about the reading of the diaries in the beginning when Daniel's reading and Louis is feeding on Rashid. We'll get there. Daniel says, I'm trying to think of something more fucked up than this.
I mean, Daniel, I that is a challenge. I will tell you that.
Claudia's recording their last words. She's taking souvenirs. She's doing all kinds of serial killer stuff.
Yeah.
And Daniel is seeing that and he is calling that out. And he calls that out in another scene where he says, you know, she didn't get hugged enough between ritualistic killings.
Yeah.
Also, he references Charles Manson. And Louis says, is that how you see her? Well, there's no other way to see her.
Yeah.
But Louis' perspective is so informed by his own vampirism.
Yeah. He's like, look, killing people is not that big of a deal, you guys.
Right. And Louis found Lestat to be gross because of how Lestat liked to toy with his kills. Claudia is not doing anything that's necessarily that different. If she's sitting there recording their last words,
and
she's
lopping off a thumb.
Yeah, she's fetishizing what she's not just killing to survive. Louis looks, I think, at killing and what he does, because of course he's claiming to still be on a vegetarian diet when he was with Claudia.
Yeah.
I think that he wants to see something different in Claudia than than what is really there. And he has a very skewed perception of who and what Claudia is. Claudia is she's more extravagant than Lestat. Lestat fetishizes the act of killing in the sense he makes it this extravagant event.
Right.
Claudia relives the killings by writing them in her diary. So she's really relishing. At least that's what is being communicated through the reading of her diary.
I think there
and remember, Rashid said there was 42 pages that went
42
on.
42 pages. Yeah. Yes.
Right. I think there's a good plot reason for that. And it has to do with the age that they put their Claudia. She was frozen in time, not as a five-year-old. And a five-year-old wants things like comfort and companionship and food. Well, a teenager wants different things. And that's a really fucked up period in a lot of teenagers' lives. You're right in the middle of that this storm of hormones, stormones, possibly, of puberty. And it's telling you, basically, it's giving you no impulse control. Your hormones are carbonated at all times. So yes, of course, she's going to seek out sex rather than just food.
The disconnect for me, because when I read the book, and even this time most recently when I read the book, I viewed Claudia as very, like, more of an innocent. And she's not. And both you and Joanne kept saying, well, she's going to be a vicious killer. And I'm like, it's Claudia with the curly blonde hair.
Claudia, I mean, you forget, because Kirsten Dunst had that perfect angelic appearance. And you forget she was also a brutal killer. It's easy to forget that because, you know, look at what you're looking at. Nobody looks at a 5-year-old and goes, well, it could snap and kill us all.
Nobody looks at Bailey Bass and thinks that she's just a lovely, cherubic looking, you know, she's like, she's just a gorgeous young girl.
She is, but she's a vampire.
I always think of Claudia as much more of an innocent than Claudia obviously is. And, you know, now that I'm doing more of a deep read, and going back and really trying to compare against what we're seeing in the show. And I'm also working through some of my theories, I'm seeing Claudia in quite a different light. This retelling of her story is actually quite effective because of the way they've done this, where Claudia fucks off, as Lestat says, to go to college.
Yeah.
Okay. So Claudia takes off for the college years, leaving Lestat and Louis in this empty nest of a home. Here at this point, they are now forced into confrontation with one another in the sense that they are stuck in those four walls. But
it's kind of like how everybody was stuck together for COVID. A lot of marriages and relationships were put to the test and a lot fell apart during that time. And you see that obviously with what goes on over the years with them. And Louis just no interest, you know, admits that he enjoys antagonizing Lestat the whole time. They did a great job showing how Lestat's resentment towards Louis and Claudia built over the years that they were sent underground to live the way that they were living. You know, we see that when she comes back and Lestat says, you sulked for thousands of hours, and the minute she walks in, you're ready to, you know, run off with her. And another great example of it was when, you know, he's reading a book and he just cannot be bothered with Lestat. And Lestat says, you know, you pine for her, but I'm the full-bodied adult with all the right appendages standing in front of you. So, if my considerables continue to be squandered, and then Louis just kind of cuts him off. And I thought that was a cute, funny kind of way for them to, you know, talk about.
Yes, and look, CGI rat number 3 had an appearance there.
Yeah.
Quick appearance.
Living in the vermin.
I better put him on the list.
they need to contract rat sniff.
Yeah, rat sniff could handle that more. Or maybe that was one of Rat Sniff's deliveries that went rogue.
Exactly.
But one big difference is another vampire in America, because they don't meet any other vampires until they go to Europe. It's more realistic that they would run into a vampire, especially when Louis is running around sending up the equivalent of vampire smoke signals by broadcasting his distress message, right? So of course, if there's a vampire out there, they're going to hear that.
She's out there studying. Now, this studying in the book was done in the home.
Yeah.
And she would discuss it with Louis.
Right.
And now, you know, this was all, she went out and did this on her own. And he was, in the book, as interested in finding out about other vampires as she was. In the series, it seems like all he's interested in.
He's like reading Baudelaire or something.
Here is where he is this is where he is whiny Louis. And he's back to not really understanding what his role is, and now he's bereft without Claudia. Well, remember, he anchored himself to Claudia as a way to redeem himself, and he is feeling like he failed
again. Here is my treasured Easter egg of the week. So as they pan around the room while Louis is taking La Petite Poisson from Rashid, you see two paintings, one of which I figured out, one of which I didn't. The black and white painting that kind of looks like a bunch of tree roots, but maybe a leg and some faces. I haven't figured that one out yet. So we're going to give that one another shot, but I think it's important. I think it's an Easter egg. But the one that's definitely an Easter egg is the Rembrandt. So you see, as you pan over, you see this kind of ship, you know, listing to one side, and it's in a stormy sea. That is Storm on the Sea of Galilee by Rembrandt van Rijn. The interesting thing about this painting and what makes it an Easter egg is that while it was painted in the 1600s, it was stolen in 1990 and has never been recovered. Guess who's got it? Louis or whoever owns that palatial tower? Joni.
There was a bit of symbolism that happened twice that I think we really need to talk about, and it was the broken mirror. In the one scene with Claudia where she screams at them, you know, when she comes in and Lestat is in her coffin and Louis outside and she screams to get out of my room, she shatters the mirror and immediately looks at her own reflection. Then there's another scene, the fight, where, you know, everything is broken and Louis is sending her the telepathic messages, stay there, don't come in here, everything's fine. And she looks over and sees the reflection of herself again in a shattered piece of glass. As you all know, obviously, broken mirrors, bad luck. But it's the symbolism obviously goes way, way, way deeper than that. You know, and it's really a reflection of her seeing herself broken, her family broken. So it can also symbolize deceit, deception. There's a million different things it can
right symbolize, inaccurate right? image, right? Because right. now it's fractured, so you're getting
right. But I think picture. Yeah, exactly. I think it's showing the fractured relationship that she feels that she's responsible for creating because she kind of did.
Now let's take that a step further. We're reading Claudia's diaries. Is she giving us an inaccurate picture of herself? Is Ooh. She yet another unreliable narrator?
I think she is an unreliable narrator.
One last thing. When Louis and Lestat are in their filthy townhouse and Louis's reading and Lestat's walking around talking about his big dick energy or whatever it was he was trying to say about his considerables.
Which are considerable, especially in that black suit.
Yeah, he's not hiding wow. anything.
Girl, you're not kidding. So Louis starts talking about the books that he's reading. And he says something about Flaubert. Gustave Flaubert is best known for his masterpiece, Madame Bovary. I'm going to read you a little part of something. He developed, from this story, developed something called the Madame Bovary syndrome. And it's typically applied to the female protagonist. Each protagonist in these stories exemplifies chronic feelings of dissatisfaction, hopelessness, and despair due to the lack of control over their own lives.
That is a good catch.
Who does that sound
is reading
like?
Emo literature and yep. completely going, I am Emma Bovary. Oh, I love it. I love that read.
These female protagonists face different forms of oppression within marriage and motherhood as part of a 19th century patriarchal societal convention. As a result, each character either attempts suicide or is driven to madness.
Ugh, yes.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, she ends it in front of she jumps in front of a train, I think, in Madame Bovary. Wow, that's an excellent read. Fantastic. I'm jealous.
The train's only moved like 30 miles an hour then, so she must have really hung in there. Are you ready to do the grand reveal?
Yeah, Christina, what are your Easter eggs?
This is Easter egg time.
All right, here's
step up. Don't be shy.
Here's the Easter egg.
Be bold.
Here's the Easter egg. He opens up the diary to the page that's about to describe what happens
right.
to Claudia,
right.
potentially.
And it ends like kind of a medieval suicide note where it kind of goes,
It ends right. like halfway through, right? Sentence. So it's just a half of a page. So this would be, if you're looking at it, this first page was on the right-hand leaf. Sorry. Then he turns the page and directly then on the left-hand
leaf. It was there again. Leaf,
it's there again.
Why
the same
was that?
We don't know. We have to wait for the series. But the same entry was on that second page.
Which would make no sense from a standard, I'm writing in my diaries, you know.
Right. On that page, it's splattered with blood. I think that also is not an Easter egg. It's more of a like foreshadowing of something. Then there are pages ripped out. This sets off an altercation between Louis and Daniel, which we'll get to. But one of the questions that we have not asked in this podcast, or at least we haven't asked it often enough, is where is Louis in modern day within the scope of the canon? Which books have happened? So this theory of mine as a guess for maybe here's what's coming or this is why these pages are missing is if the modern day interview is taking place after Merrick, then Louis has reconvened with Claudia's spirit, potentially Claudia's spirit, somewhat a spirit that definitely comes and speaks to him. And he thinks that it's Claudia.
Right.
Because of the help of Merrick. And then as a part of the spell that she casts to call Claudia's spirit forward, Louis has to make some sacrifices that will attract Claudia. She has her diary. Merrick, who used to work for the Talamasca, brings it to him and says, here's the diary. He has to read a couple of hard entries so that the reader knows what Claudia actually thought of them. And it's right. not nice. She says to him, tear out a passage and give it to me and I'm going to burn it. And that's the last you're going to see of this passage. After he has this spiritual interlude encounter with Claudia, he becomes suicidal. If we fit those puzzle pieces together, those pages that are ripped out have been ripped out because he has ripped them out to give them to Merrick to burn in the sacrifice to call forth Claudia's
spirit.
Now Louis, having had that conversation with the spirit, is in Dubai and he doesn't want to live anymore. In this episode, Rashid,
whoever that guy is,
whoever Rashid is, says he is writing a suicide note because the vampires will come for him and they will scale this building and they will paint the walls with his blood.
This is graphic, you know, but okay.
Okay. So he probably did rip them out. He probably does want to save her reputation. Who knows what she described went on? Right. It could be that it is as we are being told that she was violated and that's what's there. And Louis wants to get rid of that. And it's a hard memory. So it would be likely to call Claudia forth or something else happened. Something else was written in there.
I do think, I mean, we are making an assumption, right, about the assault, because they don't show it. Did he have that menacing predator look? Absolutely. And he makes a little sexual comment. So they definitely want us to believe that that's what his intention was. Vampires in the immortal universe get their powers a few ways based on how long they've been alive, but also who their sire is. Yeah. Absolutely. So one of the reasons that Lestat was more powerful in the Vampire Lestat than some of the vampires that were hanging around in Paris was because his maker was an ancient one. And if you drink from a more powerful vampire, you can increase your powers. Now, it gets a little Dragon Ball Z here for a while, like, oh, what's my power level? It's over 9,000. Mm-hmm. But it is possible, I'm not saying it's likely, that Claudia just beat his ass. That's a huge assumption. I just think it's only a possibility and the story will inform us
as
we move down. But I also don't want to look like I'm trying to wish the sexual assault away because that's totally possible that that's what went down.
No, I believe, like I said, I actually believe that it probably did just based on clues that I've gotten from, you know, Rollin Jones at the end of the, in his little recap where he says,
which by the way, terrible. That was super jarring.
That was hard to watch.
When Rollin Jones like, well, Claudia went out in the world and
found out it was tough. And then,
but that toughened her up. I'm like, happened?
Had a terrible thing happen to her.
Yeah.
So a terrible thing has happened to her now, whether that means a sexual assault or something else terrible.
Right.
But I can't think of anything worse.
Time will tell.
Okay. So my last little follow-up on my theory about David, because I know that as soon as the episode opened and Louis was feeding on Rashid,
Le Petit Boisson,
everybody was like, oh, online, I saw it. Well, there goes my theory about him being Armand. There goes my theory about him being a vampire because he was feeding on him. I don't know where that's coming from because they feed on each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's sex.
It doesn't happen often, but they do. And what I'm going to highlight a specific instance that I think further underlines my theory that Rashid is David is that when in Prince Lestat and David come together and they're having this conversation about what's going on with the Talamasca and the great family and the kind of this changes that are going on both of those institutions, so to speak. And then all of the sudden Lestat and David are out on the town going through all the old neighborhoods and looking for, you know, and just they're kind of out
cruising,
checking things out. Okay. I'm going to read a segment from the book. I'm thirsting, I said aloud. This is Lestat. At once he suggested where we might hunt, meaning David. Lestat said, no, for your blood.
Baby.
I said, you damnable brat, he seethed. Oh, yes. despise me, please.
Yeah, oh God. Call me Champagne Daddy.
Bad Daddy. I said as I closed in, I pushed his face to one side, kissing his throat first, and then sinking my fangs very slowly, my tongue ready for those first radiant drops. I think I heard him say the single word, caution, but once the blood struck the roof of my mouth, I wasn't hearing clearly or seeing clearly and didn't care.
We've all been there, Lestat.
Sounds like my last Saturday night.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, all right, Joe.
Calm down there, face.
I had to force myself to pull back. I held him. This is an unfortunate sentence given what you just said. I held a mouthful of blood as long as I could until it seemed to be absorbed without my swallowing.
Oh,
and I let those last ripples of warmth pass through my fingers and toes. And then David,
what is going on in this book?
David says, stick your filthy doigt du seigneur right through your greedy heart. And he walks away quickly. But then Lestat.
Can I ask what a doigt du seigneur is? It's a knife.
The right of the Lord. It's the right of the Lord. Right. Okay. So then David takes off and he's walking away quickly. He's
so fastly.
And then Lestat catches up with David and kisses him and says, if I was king of the vampires, I'd make it the right of every maker to drink from his fledgling anytime he chose. And then moments later, David turns around and takes some blood back from Lestat.
There you go. Not
only do they drink one another, they do. And it's not that they kill one another from doing it. And as a matter of fact, we saw him bite Louis in the episode.
Yes, of course.
I was waiting for you to say, Lestat said, David, you taste like honey and pineapple.
Oh, I know. All right. So that's where I still think I'm on track. I'm still going to hold on to it because he's still wearing his gloves. He's hiding his hands for some reason. Why is that? And David is one of the people that did help Louis when Louis was wanting to end his life after seeing Claudia's spirit. So.
Well, if nothing else, your theory is elaborate.
Christina, who was your standout character of this week?
Claudia.
Why would you pick Claudia? She's barely in the show.
Going from the week before where you and I, Joe, were kind of like, to this week.
So wrong.
We weren't. I just thought she was aged up a little bit too much. I'm going to stand by that, but I'm going to also say that she did a lot to reveal herself as a character in a way that she didn't in the book for me. And that is to show me through her narration, through others reading her diary. I found Claudia to become one of the most manipulative of all of the characters. And that is fascinating to me because I'm very curious to see how they're going to play this out.
I mean, there's that one scene, I think when we were watching it, you were watching it for like the ninth time or whatever it was, where she goes, Daddy Lou, are you going to let him do that to me?
Yes.
Where she's deliberately setting them against each other.
Multiple times she does.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, again, I'm not victim blaming here or anything else. She's being a teenager and is being manipulative. And what then happens because of the manipulation is way too much.
A victim can be a bad person and still not be responsible for their victimhood.
Right.
Right. She's a bad person.
Look, all of her activities in the beginning put them at risk. She was very selfish, very teenage trait. I mean, it's totally on brand for that age and for a vampire. But she then, when she comes back, says, I'm sorry, I wasn't in my right mind.
Right.
And that at least showed maybe a little bit of self-reflection. This is also a part of the character that I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable because what I see them doing is making her a caricature a little bit of a young female, which is she's young. She's fascinated with sex. Her main interest is boys. She's confused and emotional about all of these new feelings and this desire for sexuality. There's a punishment for a young woman who's trying to expand her life and trying to maybe she's frustrated over sexual things, but there's a punishment for that. And then the showrunner says this toughens her up.
Right.
So for me, that's where the sexual assault, particularly against a woman of color, becomes problematic as a conceit. Wasn't there some other way for that to, did it have to be that? Because I think it's a little bit too on the nose to have a young woman, that the loss of a boy is so overwhelming to her that she goes on this rampage. And I think that's a little bit too stereotypical of young women. I would have liked to have seen something else. And in particularly because it's a woman of color, and a little bit later on, we'll talk about a long-term experience of having things worked out on bodies of color.
It's literally the worst thing that can happen to a woman, to a human, you know, whatever gender you identify as, it's the worst thing that can happen to a human being, to be violated in that way. For the showrunners to, if this is what they've done, was do this to teach Claudia a lesson of how tough the world is, shame on them. Mm-hmm. Being a white woman, I can relate to the woman aspect of it. I cannot relate, obviously, to being a person of color watching this, but I can certainly see how a woman of color is going to have a very difficult time witnessing a white man rape a black woman. Why the sexual assault? Why the racial dynamic of it all? Was it necessary? No, you didn't need to show the very worst that could have happened.
The question is, will they be able to show that that was a reasonable
either way
choice?
They do this, they make but it so that she's lying this. About being sexually assaulted, someone's lying about her being sexually assaulted, or it was a dream. I mean, what we do,
it was just a red herring.
The fact that something is triggering is not necessarily a reason to keep it out of art,
and I agree with you on that. But what was the point of this? There was this.
You think it was gratuitous? Is that the position?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's see. But if it ends up being gratuitous and they never go back to that story, then yeah, that was a horrible choice.
What if another theory is right, that there was no sexual assault? He ripped the pages out for something else. But the things that he said, the things that Roland James said, it's almost worse if there wasn't, because then they're making us think there was for what reason.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, no.
I don't defend the Roland James afterward there. I think that was misguided and dumb.
Right. And if it's an unreliable narrator situation, now that calls into question believing women.
No, it's true.
It's so problematic.
They have to stick with the fact that it happened. They have to. That's the only way. Now they have to see that through.
Mr. Snedeker, who is your standout character for the week?
Well, my standout character is the tit in the drawer.
Oh, my.
This episode has been very revelatory as it pertains to Claudia. She has now gone from just an enthusiastic killer to a ritualistic killer. As Daniel very correctly points out, he's like, holy shit, she's a psychopath. And she is.
So is it the breast in the drawer or is it Claudia? Because it sounds like you're talking about Claudia. So you're saying symbolic of Claudia's killerness. You're Claudia actually highlighting an element of Claudia's character.
I think the breast in the drawer deserves to be its own character.
Okay. Right.
God, so, you show a guy a boob and that's all.
Now, listen to how crazy it is.
Let's just say I've seen better. typically they're attached to humans, which makes them, more appealing, I think. I just think that her trophies, including, by the way, that guy covered in flies who rolls out of the wardrobe.
Mm-hmm. Reminded me of Seven.
Yeah.
You remember that scene in Seven?
And like, as you pointed out earlier, she's, collecting all the last words of them. One interesting last word was, I thought it would happen in summer.
Oh, I know.
It's like, okay.
That's a nice lead into my character of the week.
Oh, excellent. Good. All right.
Was it the guy on the wharf who thought it was going to happen in summer?
No. It was the boy with the inner tube whose last words were, please let my dog live.
And then he put in parentheses, I did.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, she doesn't really like dogs that much.
No, so. She did. She let the dog live.
She let the dog live.
She liked to eat them.
As food. Mm. Right.
It just makes me sick to my stomach. That last word thing was so creepy.
This is not a feel good show.
No.
But in all seriousness, my standout character, of course, was Claudia. Yeah. I was proud of her when she had enough of their shit and she left and tried to venture out on her own. But, we're witnessing her becoming the ruthless killer.
This actually is a good place to talk about unreliable narrators. An unreliable narrator is simply a character who is untrustworthy in the way that they're relaying their story. The technique has been around throughout time in literature because it's a great way to to provide like tension and a surprise ending.
It's just a fancy way to call somebody a liar.
Well, it is. Well, see, an unreliable narrator but is either really. Deliberately.
Yeah.
It could be deliberately. It depends on the narrative. It could be deliberate that they are telling lies, or it could be unintentionally or misguided. Because here's the thing. All you have as an individual is your subjective experience. Right. You're not objective at all. You can only see the world the way that you can see the world. You can never really understand what's going on with other people. So I might be telling you a story that I experienced in one way. I would tell you about an event. And then if you would talk to Mark, he'd of course lie to you and tell you about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I would make myself look much better.
No. So we could share the same event, and then he could describe it in one way and I could describe it in a different way.
Well, is it kind of like the thing where people say there's three sides to every story?
Yes, it is.
Your side, my side, and the truth.
And some would even say there is no truth. A good postmodernist would get into a conversation with you about the existence of truth.
One fair truth, means. There are no good postmodernists.
No, that is a truth. There are different types of unreliable narrators. There are roguish characters who are... they have a way of exaggerating.
Right.
Then there are the madman trope, which is someone who is mentally detached from reality. So that's Fight Club. Then the naive, who is because of youth or inexperience, right. Like Holden Caulfield is somebody that's an unreliable narrator just because of his youth and his inexperience.
You're such a phony.
And then there are liars. Yes. There are people who lie to the other characters as well as to the reader about things that happen.
Now, I do think that it is not fair for a non-character to lie to you in a story.
I think if it's third person narrative.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like,
No, then
like Greek chorus type stuff.
Yeah,
right?
No, the third person narrative.
The Greek chorus cannot lie to you.
But if you're writing in the first person,
you can lie.
You can lie. And here's the thing that I think is so interesting about unreliable characters is that you, as a reader, are forced to take some responsibility for what you are reading and for being discerning about what you are reading.
That's exactly right. You have to be a critical reader.
Yes.
And so we sought out some expert advice on this topic, but she is a Browning scholar. She gave me some examples in literature. A lot of times the character who is the unreliable narrator still reveals truth by the way they lie. So if we find out that Louis has, lied in the entire interview with the vampire, well, it's interesting to him as a character to find out why he lied. Was he just in denial? Was he trying to cover something up? Was he trying to achieve some other plot or plan? We'll see. But she does say a lot of her students get fooled if the book has an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to be able to read critically and think critically to say, okay, let me just stick a pin in that and see if that turns out to mm-hmm. be true, rather than just say everything on the written page must be true.
The contest is to see if the author can trick you. Weren't you tricked by Verbal Kent in Usual Suspects?
But that's not the same thing as the narrator lying. If somewhere in The Sixth Sense showed Bruce Willis and the little kid interacting with other people, that would be a lie.
No, but they did things that made it look that way. It's not a lie. It's just exactly what you were talking
but
about.
In a well-written twist, you should be able to go back and find the clues to say, oh, I should have realized that.
Right? Absolutely. So here's the question I want to use as a follow-up for that. And maybe this will take us into character arc. Are any of these people reliable narrators?
I mean, look, is Rollin Jones a reliable narrator at this point? We don't know what the hell's going on anymore.
Are the writers? Do you remember in the very first episode, I think it was, I said, or maybe it was the second episode, after Louis was turned and he said, I got to get home. I got to go see Paul and Grace. And we said, well, that must have just been that Louis himself was so distraught he was confused that Paul was dead already. And now come to find out online, and in fact, in last week's episode, we mentioned it as kind of an Easter egg or theory, or like, this is a weird thing. There was a page in Claudia's diary where it was an excerpt from the vampire Lestat.
Yeah.
And we identified that. We saw that.
Right.
And talked about it last week. Well, it turns out the writer's room on Twitter from the official writer's room posted it and said, you know, mistakes happen. And then they showed some bloopers in different movies. One was the Starbucks cup in Game of Thrones.
Yep.
And one was the picture of Lestat's entry into Claudia's diary. So they made a mistake there. And now, come to find out, in this week's episode, we see Grace showing Louis that she has had to figuratively, if not literally, bury him. And it shows his year of birth. And in it says one thing on the stone. And then on the one of the promos, he gives a different year of birth. So here's what I'm saying are the writers. There could be some things, particularly the little
fuck up.
The little details. That's a really good catch. I didn't write anything down about his date of birth. I noted his date that she marked his date of death, October 18th, 1930, but I didn't even think to fact check the birth date.
I just, now I'm wondering, like, okay, are the writers making mistakes?
Are they
dude?
High?
What's happening?
Okay, you guys drunk?
I love your art, you guys, but please, like, yeah. We need some continuity. Yeah.
Go home, writers. You're drunk.
No, we're just kidding. Love the work that we're seeing from the writers. But that this whole character arc thing for me, now I'm sitting here watching everybody suspicious as hell.
That's what you're looking for from a drama. So you should be even more engaged in your critical examination of this show. You know, don't believe everything you're told. Louis may get to the point where he's like called out on something or whatever, and he'll have to say, okay, might have made that up a little
bit. Or he gets called out to the point that he has to make somebody's body shake so they stop asking him questions.
Yes, exactly, Joanne.
Yeah. What was in those four pages?
That's right. In the case where this is an interview and I'm here to talk to you about this, I'm going to tell you this story. And you can tell that there is an ongoing battle between the two of them. Daniel doesn't believe that Louis being totally honest.
Oh, he's
and
definitely
Louis
not being.
Wants Daniel to tell the story he wants Daniel to tell. And that battle is going back and forth and back and forth. And I think that what Louis in misrepresenting something potentially or misremembering again, remember there are different ways, you know, and he says this, the odyssey of recollection for him to be able to tell this story in this way. That's a next level, right? Cause he's trying to influence something happening.
That's right. So let's say, okay, what is or are Louis's motives? Is his motive to tell a journalistically factual story? I don't think it is. I think he's trying to do some kind of call to action or a warning. But if he's doing those things, then a simple factual retelling of his life might not accomplish that.
You're right. Because understand there's multiple layers of narration here.
Of course.
You mentioned the writers, but yeah. That's actually fair. They're writing this story. So what they, you know, their narration has to get to a certain point where maybe there's a twist or maybe something, you know, we don't know what's coming. All of a sudden, woo, big surprise. We have to, as viewers, be able to go back and say, you know, for it to be really good, we've got to be able to go back and say, oh, that's where those pieces fit together.
Correct.
And I will go back once again to the point that these showrunners came from Better Call Saul. And if anybody watched that show, there were lots of twists and turns and intricate schemes that were going on, and it was executed flawlessly. Yeah. You could go back and you could say, oh my God, I should have seen that coming.
I think in the ultimate revelation, we're going to see, okay, here's what Louis was trying to do. And my guess is he wasn't trying to write his biography.
He's told what he's doing it for.
As a warning.
A warning.
Yeah.
So we know that that's what he's saying it is. Is that what it is?
Well, and then Rashid says that basically it's his suicide note.
Right.
If Louis is chronicling his own suicide, to quote Rashid, it's kind of ironic. What's the, you know, he does not like many things about Lestat, but he hates how he kills so extravagantly. This is an extravagant suicide.
I mean, that's a weird way to go out. Yeah.
Open up the door, walk outside, poof, right. You're
no,
gone.
You have to open up the door. You just stand in that where he's got right. The hole in the roof. Get, yeah.
You know, if he wanted to expose vampires, go on TV and expose the vampires. There were so many other ways he could have done it that would have been less dramatic or extravagant. And it's almost like he's toying with Daniel and with the
and
retelling
Rashid.
Of the story.
Rashid
and
obviously Rashid. Cares for him. And he's you know, that's like someone saying, look, you're doing this thing and this is going to end badly. I'm going to lose you, whatever they're really
arguing.
No.
He said was Rashid is a man of many opinions, even when he's not asked or something like that.
Yeah. In terms of character arc, though, just the relationship breaking down completely between Louis and Lestat. Absolutely. And Lestat is just kind of maintaining or trying to maintain his Lestatness as Louis just sinks deeper and deeper into this depression. Instead of just ending the relationship with Louis, he decides he's going to have an affair. He's stepping out again with Antoinette. This is strange to me about Lestat's character, but I know where it's coming from, like the abandonment, the fear of being abandoned.
And I mean, how long did he hang on to Nikki?
Yeah. What ended up happening at the end of this episode, his character breaking like that, that's been building. And those abuses have been, this has been, and I think I said it last episode, watching Lestat through the season, I see him becoming increasingly abusive in straightforward ways, but also in the way that he often ignores Louis's situation as a man of color. It's just kind of unaware or just doesn't think much of it. He doesn't take it as seriously as he ought to. So there's been a lot of abuse that's been happening frequently in toxic relationships where there's domestic violence. There's a lot of emotional stuff that goes on first before someone gets violent. And then the cycle begins again. And also it is not against Lestat's character. In multiple occasions in interview, once with Babette and then another time around the making of Claudia, there are physical altercations between the two of them that get very violent. She doesn't go into pages and pages of detail. But if you're sitting in that writer's room and you think, okay, well, they've got to have a fight, what is that fight going to look like? It's going to look like what it looked like.
Look like a fucking vampire fight.
And it was brutal. When he's dragging him down the hallway and he's got his fingers in his jaw, he says to him, I fought myself a million times, fought my nature, controlled my temper. I never once harmed you. And that just speaks volumes to the violent, toxic vampire that he truly is. There's a myriad of reasons that people are upset over this scene, but some are just simply upset because they're saying, my Lestat would never hit Louis like that.
He did multiple times.
Yeah, he did. And by the way, ask Armand.
Right. He has done it. And not only that, he says he was fighting his nature. This is his nature. This is your Lestat.
In fact, the show has been a lot less physically violent than I remembered the sort of early stages of the book, right? When they're first getting together and before they have Claudia, and then because they used to have terrible angry fights all the time. They're always arguing. As I said, with Babette, there's a point where Lestat's going to kill her and Louis says no. And then they have a brawl right there in the little cellar thing where they're in. And then another time around when Claudia, before he made her and then after he made her, there was another. And they're kicking each other. They threw me against the wall and all of this. Yeah. That is, they have that. There's the textual evidence for that.
One of the central themes is becoming a vampire is a problem.
Yes.
This is one of the offshoots of that, that it makes you are a violent, super powerful killer. When your best tool is a hammer, all problems look like nails.
Yes. Joanne, you said something before about people feeling like, you know, they just want to like Lestat. Mm-hmm. You can. Go ahead. Yeah. Like him.
But you have to realize.
But he is the way he is. I mean, and this is the way that he is. It's not easy to see on the screen sometimes. I, you know, and this is, of course, my opinion, but I think that it's being pretty true to life. True to text, I guess, is the better way to put that. But I would say that does not take away the problems that are inherent in this scene.
Claudia was born as a Band-Aid for a broken relationship. The resentment that Lestat has bred for her over the years because of her relationship with Louis or whatever his issues are, he calls her a mistake. When she calls out to him as he's pulling Louis down and she says, Uncle Les, and he says, oh, it's Uncle Les suddenly again. Mm-hmm. And she said, let him go. It's me you want. And he said, listen very carefully, my infant death. It was never you. So that's really true to life for me. But then there's this other part of it that when they're up in the air, Lestat says, I've waited in vain for you to love me. Tell me that you've never loved me and make it easier on me. That is such classic abuser abused conversation.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yep.
An abused person, what they normally do, what I did when I was in an abusive relationship, to satiate your abuser, to make them stop. You say it's your fault. And that was what Lestat needed Louis to say to make him be able to stop. You know, for the people that watched it that were upset about not having the domestic violence trigger warning, or just the fact that these things happened at all, I understand exactly what they were feeling. But that moment just really kind of culminated the entire toxicity of their relationship. And when Louis just said to him, the only words he said was, "Let go of me." The writers really nailed that abuser abused moment of, "I'm sorry, it was my fault," you know, because that's what Lestat needed to hear. Louis would not give it to him. And
so in this arc with the end in domestic violence, it's been an abusive relationship all along. Daniels called it out. A lot of people online have been talking about whether or not that's the case. We feel like that it certainly has been abusive. There's a path to it. They've made it make sense. That deserved a trigger warning. We have to stop to understand. Now, we're three white people. We should be doing more listening and learning than talking about it ourselves, because of course we don't share that experience. We don't have the understanding of what it feels like to be a person of color with the history that is embedded in that, in terms of violence to Black bodies, right? And that long shared experience that is there. We can't access that, but we can witness that it exists. My hope is that in some way that AMC witnesses that it exists, because they really must. A couple of episodes ago, I said,
raise the issue previously.
Yeah. Right?
Like, you know, where Louis is pointing out to Lestat how different their lives are because of who he is.
Right. But now for a white man to abuse a Black man's body, there is textual support for it happening, but it's a different book when it's two white men.
But this episode was riddled with white on Black assault. Even yes. Daniel slapping Louis. That was a white man getting up and, for lack of a better term, I mean, he just bitch slapped him.
There's a lot of,
I mean, I get why, but again, it was just another perch. It was just like this whole episode was riddled with it.
Now, can you say that things were done in self-defense in some of these cases? I don't know. I don't know if you can even have that conversation. What I see happening here is just toxicity all around.
Correct.
And Rollin Jones said, "I want to do a show about a toxic relationship." The whole show is everybody's toxic. You've got Daniel and Louis. That's a toxic situation that's happening there.
And Rashid and Louis are toxic.
You can't be surprised by that. If you know anything about the book, the previous movie, the show, I'm just saying that is 100% was going to be a central theme of this show.
I think that there still would have been some questions about the textual reasonability of it, and certainly and should have been over the racial implications. That I think both of those things still would have been discussed. But I think if there had been a trigger warning, at least to kind of clue people in, the racial aspect of it is the thing that troubles me probably the most.
Right.
We said this is going to be thorny, but that subtext of master-slave was there. It was subtextual.
Yeah.
It wasn't race-based.
Really, the only right answer would have been to not have this scene ever happen, because there was no way the showrunners could have done it in a way that pleased everybody.
You have to evaluate it as a work of art. Is it a good show?
And I think that's easier said than done when you're not part of a marginalized community, though.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that we just have to respect the fact that that is a fraught thing, that scene, it happened. You can't pretend that it didn't. I think that you have to deal with what you're watching as a part of whatever that is in that story, but also contend with it and witness it as something that is traumatic to many, many, many people, and try to have some understanding of why that's why, I guess, why, and bearing witness to it again, not just watching it, not just going, "Oh, wow, that was intense, but really thinking maybe I don't know. I mean, God, that sounds like fucking thoughts and prayers. I don't even know. There's no good answer to this. They've done a weird thing here.
If it ends up that that was a completely gratuitous scene and doesn't impact on the character arcs or the story, then we blame them for that.
Well, I tell you how they're going to fix. They're going to have it. So they'll say, well, now it makes sense why he would kill Lestat. Now he has a reason to kill Lestat.
Possibly.
But also, in the scope of a toxic, abusive relationship is also sometimes the case.
Yeah.
The abused then turns around and injures or harms in some way their abuser. Sure. And so it's going to be interesting to see what comes out over the next several days. So we're going to do body count.
Yeah, let's do body count.
Ready.
Bear with me here because I kind of lost focus a little bit while I was watching the show. Number one, CGI rat.
Well, he does die, but it's later in the episode.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying. This
I thought you were going in order.
Oh, no. Fuck that. At least 56 floaters. And then who else do we have, Joni?
We had the man at the wharf who always thought he would go in summer.
Yes, that's correct.
There was the drunk man in Claudia's wardrobe.
So much wine.
According to the closed caption, was alive.
Yeah,
yes,
no, he was alive.
He was making noises.
He was just not at all well.
No.
And he had flies.
Oh, wishing God. He was dead. The college boy that Claudia and Bruce
killed. Yes.
Oh, there you go. Very good.
And last but not least, the lady in the alley when Claudia, right after she sees Grace and Louis at the cemetery, and she's sitting in the alley kind of pondering life and what she's going to do. There's a lady in a blue overcoat dead next to her.
It was a fade over to an alley?
She was sitting in an alley, yes.
Oh, how weird. I saw it as she was sitting behind the stacks. Yeah. But yeah, that's probably
so
right.
So we thought we had a lot of bodies last week. Whew, we got way more this week.
Holy cow, they really did stack up Claudia, man. She's way ahead.
Yeah, she is pulling into the lead for the season's kill contest. Horrific, horrible deaths that entertain us.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Why don't we do a few just wrap up thoughts on this episode? I just think it's going to be a really hard episode to get over for a lot of people. I think this is going to be that episode that just people keep coming back to and coming back to. If this lasts for six seasons, they're going to be like, yeah, but season one, episode five.
The title of this episode is A Vile Hunger for Your Hammering Heart. What are they talking about, Joni?
For Louis and Lestat. Lestat has a vile hunger for Louis's hammering heart. It's him yearning for Louis's love.
I think it is Claudia's vile hunger for the kill. You read descriptions in Rice's books about how it feels when they kill somebody. The heartbeat becomes present in the moment, right? They feel the person's heart beating. Their heart starts beating at the same time, and then that heartbeat weakens, eventually dies. Any of those answers could be absolutely correct because they're all nursing some pretty vile hungers.
I think that's when Louis talks to Claudia about how he took her life initially.
Right.
And he had a vile hunger for your hammering heart.
Absolutely.
So I think that's where it came from. But I like all of those. I like the answers to those questions. Okay, Joe, what do you have for final conclusion?
I'm happy with the episode as it was portrayed. I have a difficult time with some of the racial aspects of it. It was uncomfortable. And I wish that AMC would have handled that differently. I wish that they would have put a trigger warning. Those things aside, and I'm not pushing them aside or making light of them or disregarding them or in any way, shape, or form. The story is the story, like Mark has said. It's still a great story. And I love the movement of Claudia into this sick, sadistic killer who is even more extravagant than Lestat could ever possibly be. I hope that AMC corrects some of these issues going forward. And I hope more than anything that I'm right about the four pages in the diary.
Well, would you like to take us out this week, ma'am?
Well, that's it for us tonight, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. As always, if you enjoyed us, please remember to share us with a friend. And if you want to, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @vampire_insider. What you're going to find there is lots of conversation and a little bit of trolling and funny jokes. But we also are now going to try to hold spaces regularly to discuss each episode. And we also like to ask for our listeners' input on things you want to hear. We just did our first spaces the other day, and I want to thank the people that did participate, especially River, who is @antinostalgic, Danny's Vampire Error @feedthemachine, Jennifer Bowler @creativespoonie, and Dorian @LestatzaWhore. Also, a very, very, very special thank you to Linda Codega Vamp Era, who can be found at LINCODEGA. They are a journalist for Gizmodo.com and IO9. Thank you, guys.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.
Bye.
First of all, you were right. 56, not 156.
I take no joy in that.
Shut up, Mark. Let me remind you of the Fennec Fox.
I take so much joy in that. I think this week's episode should be, it was 56, Mark was right. And really, it was Christina was right because she gave me the number.
Mark, you don't quite know who you're talking to. Joanne is one of the most vicious trolls on Twitter.
I know.
I will dox the shit out of you. You might find this surprising, but I've made more than a few grown men cry in my day.
I don't even doubt that a little bit.
Yeah, don't fuck with me.